Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and on this episode of Wandering DMs, we're going to talk about vampires. One of those, possibly the most powerful undead type in original D&D, and we're wondering how we have used them and how you, the viewers, have used them. Are they the best as the big bad in your campaign, or do they randomly show up in a dungeon? All about vampires today on this October episode of Wandering DMs.
So interesting that you worded it that way, Dan, because I was looking at some of the entries of vampires in different editions of D&D, and one of the consistent things is that specific call out of the AD&D first edition monster manual says that they're the most dreaded of chaotic evil undead, and expert BX set tells us that they're the most feared of the undead, period, most feared.
Yeah. You can see that in early materials. You can see like players going way out of their way to find ways to defend themselves against vampires. And clearly in original D&D, they were the top of the end. They were the top tier undead monster, no doubt about it. And they kind of just break the game at that level in some point. So a lot of players were in fact really, really worried about them. And I can't remember where I saw it, but I saw somebody designing like a specialized magic item that was the collar of vampire protection, just trying to protect, just one item with nothing but trying to protect yourself from vampire bites.
Oh, it doesn't protect vampires. It protects you from vampires. I see.
Correct.
So a call out here in the chat, which is actually something I'm looking at right now, which is that the video seems to be labeled 10 Dead Rats, Season 4, Episode 8. Sorry, everyone. That's obviously a mistake. This is not 10 Dead Rats. interesting though, because vampires play a big role in 10 Dead Rats, and so yet another reason for us to discuss vampires.
That's true. We'll be fixing some stuff in post. Sorry about that labeling.
I'm gonna fix that live right now because
okay.
Because
okay.
I can.
We have that. Okay, we have that capacity. You know, one thing we might as Paul's fixing that. You know, one question in my mind is like, where do we get our pulp influences of vampires? And you know, so for many of us, we like to say we're people of the book, and we're looking at literary influences or mythological influences. But on the other hand, this might be a case where the tradition of D&D vampires very much comes out of movies, 20th century movies, like Hammer horror films and stuff like that. Now me, okay, I wasn't a big horror movie guy, frankly. So for me, I would say that my sensibility of vampires do come out of literary influences. For example, I recently read David Madison's Tower of Darkness short story, where some fantasy heroes go into a city and there's a temple that only operates at night, and spoiler alert, the whole thing is just a bunch of vampires preying on people in the city. And big thanks to Peter Bebergall's Appendix N anthology for bringing that to our attention. Before that, I really adored, probably in college, I got John Steakley's Vampires novel, that's Vampires Ending with a Dollar Sign, about a bunch of modern day mercenaries who hunt down and kill vampires for pay. And that got late. I like that novel a lot. That later got turned into a movie directed by John Carpenter, starring James Woods, which kind of starts out similar and then has a very different ending to it. So Paul, when you think about...
Yeah, I was going to say, let's not forget the various gaming influences. That's where my head went first, is, okay. You know, the first big RPG I was aware of that was not D&D was, of course, Vampire the Masquerade, very big when I was in
college.
It's a whole RPG just about vampires.
Right,
You've got the... you've got the... the movies, the Antonio Banderas movie,
Twilight.
that's not what I was thinking of.
Oh God, really?
Oh, thank you.
Really?
I was thinking of Interview with a Vampire, which my head was still in the 90s. There,
right. And, God, what's her name? Right. What is her name?
Like based on the books right. by Anne. Come on, brain, kick it in here. Sheesh.
The funny thing is, I read the sequel to Interview with a Vampire, actually, like The Vampire Queen or something like that. Rice. Yeah,
Rice.
Thank you, everybody.
Rice.
There we go.
Oy.
The research team races to the line on that. Thank you so much. Man,
oh,
Rice.
Boy.
See, I wanted to say Anne McCaffrey, which obviously was going to be a terrible, embarrassing thing, and I shouldn't have just said it right now. What am I doing? God.
Skip that. And then I'll also point out, you know, again, I was referring to 10 Dead Rats, which has vampires in it. And of course, 10 Dead Rats is based in the Warhammer world, where vampire counts is an entire army it's like the major undead army line in Warhammer. There's actually a secondary undead one that's more Egyptian themed. But you get a lot of vampire stuff in Warhammer. So, all that, I don't know. It's very, you know, very confused, I suppose. Like, isn't, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Dan, but isn't the, like, origin of the clerical turn undead ability that sort of classic trope of holding up the cross to the vampire and having it back away?
That's how I would read that. That's totally how I would read that. Yeah. And you've tapped into a really interesting vein there, Paul, because, you know, undead are... you know, terribly, I mean, among the reasons in classic D&D why they're so scary is that they drain your levels. And of course, you get to things like wights or wraiths, and they're draining one level per hit. And then vampires drain two levels every time they hit you. Just like, you're sixth level. Well, now you're fourth level. And now you're second level two rounds later. That's crushing. So yeah, the clerical turning ability to try to hold that off very much feels like that. And there are some people that say actually the entire cleric class was fundamentally inspired by Dracula's arch enemy Van Helsing. That the original idea for the cleric class was really we want a Van Helsing character in the game specifically to fight against vampires. So to some extent, the blame for the cleric class falls squarely on the head of our vampires.
Let me dig in a little bit here, because this is something I found surprising while I was preparing for
today's show. And Ash was, I see Ash saying this kind of the same thing in the chat, so thank you for that.
Yeah. So here's the text from my first edition monster manual on vampires, most dreaded of the chaotic evil undead. Which I find a really interesting call out, because does that mean there's like a different most dreaded of lawful evil undead, or like do I have to classify by alignment here when I think of my undead or all undead chaotic evil? No, I'm not sure. Anyway,
in that game, yes, in that game, there's clearly no lawful and there's clearly no good undead. So
okay,
that's an interesting point of redundancy. By the word.
So here's an interesting thing. So I was looking at this, and you have there's a lot of stuff that we get with vampires, right? They're intelligent undead, so they have all the undead rules, and then often a lot of intelligent, you know, humanoid rules where you get stuff like possibly a spellcasting ability or stuff like that. Actually, I can't remember if AD&D vampires actually had spellcasting ability, but. And then you have like all of the like classic tropes of weaknesses of a vampire, right? That they're, you know, sunlight causes them damage, maybe running water causes them damage, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, I was looking at my AD&D, I'm getting back to my point here. I was looking at my AD&D text on the vampire, and then the second column tells me vampires recoil from strong garlic, the face of a mirror or a cross, or several other holy symbols of lawful good, if any of these objects are presented boldly. Note, however, that none of these devices harm or drive the monster off. They do cause a vampire to hesitate 1-4 rounds before attacking. In the case of garlic, a mirror holy symbol will cause a vampire to position itself, so the object is not between the vampire and its intended victim. why are there a whole set of special rules here for the holding up of the cross? Isn't that what Turn Undead is meant to be? What's going on here? Why do I need a separate set of rules to special case the entire thing that inspired Turn Undead?
Yes, exactly.
What? I'm so totally so confused.
All that stuff is directly in the text of original D&D, you know, in 1974. So those are bits and pieces that were written right from the very inception of D&D. And I will once again use our friend John Peterson's idiom of these things were reckoned loosely at the time of, yeah, you know, and I wonder, like, how were those mechanics handled? So yeah, the specifics of exactly what the garlic is doing aren't spelled out, and the specifics of how do you know that you've successfully held the cross up strongly aren't spelled out.
Apologies, I've accidentally jumped the entry here to the expert set of the VX entry with our nice Willingham art there of vampires, which is right, an interesting comparison point for vampires, I think. Anyway, fascinating. Yeah, pointed out in the chat, not everyone's a cleric. So, of course, giving them this extra weakness to holy symbols held aloft means your fighter can do it, right?
Great point. Great point, yes. Yes. That's a great point.
And if you're playing in Dan's campaign, no one's a cleric. Yes, correct, William. Yep. So, fact,
that's a really this is interesting
one,
point.
One chance to turn undead in, or have a turn undead-like ability in Dan's campaign is to buy a holy symbol and hold it up to a vampire. Great.
This is a really weird moment for me of having a light bulb go off, realize that there actually is a point that I hadn't considered about that. That could actually happen in my game. That's a bad idea. Wow. See, boy, Gary was thinking way ahead, Paul. He was thinking ahead.
You think that he was prepared for someday someone is going to play without clerics, and I want to make sure. Oh, you know what's going on is, the timer is set here. Yeah, it's just changing on me. All right,
but you know,
our images were set to auto advance. There we go. On
that might actually suggest a theory that maybe that text that we're looking at here was written before clerics. And you know, if I go back to what is identified as the Beyond This Point Be Dragons, which we're pretty sure is a pre-publication draft of D&D, all that same language is in there. So our clerics at that point, but right sitting here right this second, one had to come before the other, and maybe that text for vampires came first. Of course, Dave Arneson was playing originally with chainmail rules that don't have clerics. They have heroes and they have wizards, but clerics hadn't been invented yet. So, you know, maybe vampires such as Sir Fang, which some of our viewers remind us about in Dave Arneson's Blackmoor campaign, came first. Wrote that text, and then some player said, I really want a Van Helsing-like cleric character, and maybe the clerics came, and the turning came later.
Our research team in the chat is just nailing it here and pointing out, by the way, that mummies are lawful evil, Dan. So, there you go.
Oh, there is a lawful D&D if you want to be a Philistine.
And we were looking at the AD&D entry right here, which is the one that calls out that they're the most feared.
Well, I was trying to be polite. I was trying to be polite. But they're chaotic in original D&D, right? They're chaotic in original D&D. That's what we're
looking at. Okay, D&D, just chaotic. Mommy's just chaotic. Great. Interesting. Yeah, that would be pretty weird.
That's a good point.
Huh. Have you used vampires much, Dan? Have you put many vampires in your games?
Not a heck of a lot. I have, or not that the players have actually run into. I'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. So I have, I've had vampires in my campaigns, and I haven't had players run into them too much. And I kind of wonder what will happen in those cases, because they have such a deep list of powers that the players are unlikely to be able to overcome. I got to admit, I myself as DM a little leery about running them against the players, because I think it's like quite likely to be a TPK all the time.
Interesting. I feel like for me, vampires show up in campaigns in one of sort of two dramatically different ways. Mm-hmm. One is as the absolute horror of a monster that it is presented here pretty boldly for us in the monster manual of like, it just has all these powers and it lives. I think it even tells us that they live someplace weird. Is that right? That they, am I remembering this correctly? Maybe I'm jumping back and forth here a little bit to the BX entry. I'm going to jump back on over to that guy. I'm getting lost here. Point being, you can run it sort of as that horrible, horrible monster, just like out to suck blood and destroy, players. Or you can also play them as your sort of more social, sexy vampire, right? Your vampire who's here to hide itself in amongst society and be scary, but in that sort of like, you know, in plain sight kind of way. And it's there to, maybe seduce your player characters or otherwise, bring them into drama.
This is an interesting aspect of the pop culture that you could do either. And obviously you could do either. And I know that, obviously a vampire has a fairly large role on your 10 Dead Rats campaign, which is awesome. On the other hand, I remember I was rooming with our friend BJ, actually, one of the years we went to Gen Con. And I remember very distinctly, this was the time when the Twilight movies were coming out and getting a lot of attention. And I remember BJ turning to me at some point, just furious. He was just furious. And I think what he said to me was, vampires shouldn't be attractive. They should be destroyed. And I'm like, strong argument, Mr. Johnson. I'm going to remember that.
Destroyed.
And that's actually one of the themes of the John Steakley Vampires book that kind of has influenced me, is specifically that even though that was written circa 1990 or whatever, even though vampires portray themselves as these sexy entities, that's actually purely hypnotic fakery. And if you really actually look at them objectively, they're these horrible, decrepit, things instead. And you've got to drag them into the sunlight and burn them because there's nothing else you can possibly do with them. And I tend to lean. So, those are my influences, frankly. And I tend to lean towards this truly disgusting parasite type interpretation. And that's the way I would personally go in my games. What's that movie with this was going to come up and I was going to forget the director's name. 1991-ish Dracula movie directed by I think the gentleman who directed Godfather. So it's called Bram Stoker's Dracula was the name of the movie.
Right. Yep.
And they do the same thing. They do the same flip-flop, right? So sometimes you see him looking very human and very attractive, and then it flips, and he looks really disgusting in other shots. And so I kind of that's kind of my sensibility, is that the attractiveness is fake, and the reality is something really gross.
Interesting. Fascinating. It's definitely, I will say that in 10 Dead Rats, the presence of vampires came about in a very interesting and unusual way. First of all, it's worth pointing out that in Warhammer Fantasy, you have the vampire counts, which is a whole army, a whole section. There's a whole chunk of lore in Warhammer about vampires. In fact, I'll even chuck this up here. There's a whole book on them. There's the Night's Dark Masters, which is all about the different kinds of vampires that live in the Warhammer world. And there's a large, large variety of them, drawing on all kinds of different influences. The original impetus, and people who've watched 10 Dead Rats may know that Count Orlok shows up very early in the game. He has nothing to do with the Enemy Within campaign that as written, except that it's based on a random encounter in the second book of The Enemy Within, it has this just sort of like, here's some random things that can happen to your players while they're traveling on the river. And there's this idea of Count Orlok. And here I'll show a little snippet from that book.
Basically,
you have a guy who's, you know, just a merchant, and he's on a boat and he's shipping around, and he's got this crew, and they have a big box in the hold, and they don't know what's in it, and it turns out there's a vampire in it. And that's Count Orlok. And the funny thing is, the way it's presented is that it's like kind of like a little mystery for the players to solve, of just like, oh, my crew keeps getting sick, I don't know what's going on. And the players can kind of dig into that if they want. And it's a really well-written little encounter. It's a page long. And it's just this nice little encounter of like, well, maybe the players will try to figure out what's going on, and maybe they'll encounter the vampire. Maybe they won't, and maybe the vampire will end up getting shipped to where it meant to get shipped, and then a plague, a mysterious plague, will break out in that town, right? Because there's this vampire there living there now. But I think generally the text kind of assumes the players will probably figure it out and kill the vampire relatively easily, I think, right? Mm-hmm. The assumption is that even though vampires are horrific killers in this game, that like by figuring out that it is a vampire, that's the interesting part of the mystery. And then once you know that, like, pretty easy to just haul the stinking thing up onto the deck during the day and open the box and you're done. Right. Also running water and you're on a river. Like, there's just a lot of ways you could just horrifically kill Count Orlok very quickly. So I threw him in there and the players let him out and they had a little encounter with him and it got a little bloody, and then off he flew. Like, he escaped. They got him down to like not many wounds left, and so he turned into a bat and flew away. And then he became a recurring character in my game, partly because of the influence of Matt Berry. So here's another great vampire influence for you, which I think is great, especially if you like humor in your game, which is the movie and then the subsequent television show, What We Do in the Shadows, which involves a bunch of... It's basically presented as a mockumentary, you know, camera crew following around a group of modern-day vampires, and just the ridiculousness of the idea of a situation of vampires actually living in modern New York. it's pretty funny. I definitely recommend it. And Matt Berry is a personal favorite, so I just started invoking him into this Count Orlok character. So the odd thing for me in that campaign is that I wasn't trying to present vampires as good, but nor are they the most evil thing in the campaign. Mm-hmm. There's much worse things in the campaign. So, yeah. And the players aren't the nicest people, right? In my game, my players are pretty morally ambiguous. Right. So, like, them deciding to kind of have an uneasy truce with the vampires and each group kind of use each other as they see fit kind of worked. It just kind of worked. And so it's become this ongoing shtick of them, of the players and the vampires, kind of both being like, well, these guys are way worse, and we should probably stop, you know, these cultists and demons and stuff are a problem. So we should probably work together on that one. And otherwise, we'll try to manipulate each other to our own ends.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah. But I think I was strongly influenced by What We Do in the Shadows, and then also some of the stuff like what you mentioned of Bram Stoker's Dracula, right? Where I like having those... I like having more of those social situations in the game where, like, here's a, you know, this is a horrific monster, but right now he's in plain sight, and like, maybe that's, I don't know, maybe you don't want to like fight him right in the middle of the town square right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of value out of that.
Yeah, yeah, he's a funny character. Right. Definitely a sort of improv yes and, a lot of yes and moments that made that character into an important part of our game. But there's so many tropes about vampires, and there's stuff I've had to work around, like, you know, the ability to, like, are they killed by sunlight, right? That's like a classic. They're killed by sunlight. And like, unless you're going to set your whole game at night, what do you do about that? Personally, I ended up inventing a magic item because what the heck, we're in a fantasy role playing game. Why wouldn't vampires invent magic items to, get around their weaknesses? So they have some magic glasses that block out the sun.
Good point. And there's many examples of that in the literature, and some of us in the chat were talking about how in Bram Stoker's Dracula novel, Dracula could go out in the daytime. Maybe he didn't have the entire capacity of his powers available then, but he could go out in the daytime. And that actually kind of makes sense for, like, how are you going to disguise yourself super well if you literally never go out in the sunlight? That seems like that would be, like, a pretty immediate cue that something's up. And apparently we think that the Nosferatu movie was the first time that the sunlight immediately killing them came into play. And if I didn't misread him, Ash is saying Count Orlok originally comes from the Nosferatu movie. Was that act literally a character in the movie?
Oh, it could be. I mean, he's called Count Orlok in the book. I didn't make that name up myself.
Right, sure.
So, I mean, the original Nosferatu movie was a silent film, wasn't it? So
I think so. Yeah, right.
I don't know. Maybe there's a title card in there somewhere where they refer to him as Count Orlok. I don't know. It's interesting.
Any time in any film, any character does this, like, rises without bending, right? I always call it the Nosferatu move, because I believe that's the first appearance of the vampire in the Nosferatu movie. Fascinating. Thank you, Ash.
Yeah.
Super cool. You know, one of the things I noticed in that Warhammer block is that's, again, in old school gaming, that's a really small stat block. That was like 10 numbers and then one sentence. And think about how much gaming value you've gotten in Ted Den Rats out of that that 1-inch by 3-inch stat block. That's amazing.
I mean, that stat block, that's just a snippet from the overall encounter. That's maybe a quarter of the one page on the encounter, right? So those are the stat blocks, and there's maybe a couple paragraphs of text about it. Gotcha. But yeah, you're right. It is very open, and it's a really well-written encounter, I think, because, again, it doesn't prescribe any outcome, right? It just thinks of this clever idea of, you know, what if someone tried to ship a vampire without the crew of a boat knowing that that's what they're carrying, right? So what if we stick a vampire in a box and you know, have them shipped down the
river? Really interesting. So our crack research team is everybody's confirming that, and I thought I'd seen the movie Nosferatu, but I could not remember the name of the vampire. And among other people there, William is saying Count Orlok was the main character in the Nosferatu movie, and the movie was ordered destroyed on copyright grounds, I guess because they thought they were infringing on Dracula. Fascinating. Fascinating. What great pedigree that is, Paul. Yep. Now, again, the portrayal in Nosferatu is that's a really ugly character. That is not an attractive, sexy character at all. So it's kind of interesting, again, how those things have had the rough edges shaved off or reinterpreted over the years, like many things, obviously.
I don't know. I mean, I think even in, like, I feel like that's the thing that's played with in the Bram Stoker's Dracula movie, right? Of sort of the different levels of, like, you know, this character is supposed to be, like, really attractive and exciting, but is, like, kind of gross and old and has weird hair and long fingernails and stuff.
Right.
So here's an interesting thing. Like, how do we see this play out in D&D? In our D&D stat blocks, of course, we get the ability for charm effects, right? Our vampires can charm.
Right.
Through their gaze. And I just want to compare this one a little bit.
Yep.
And again, I'm kind of going to look at across a couple editions here, but let's crack open the AD&D edition again, just for a starting point. This tells me, can I find it?
Looking for the charming.
Yeah. The charming, where is that one in here? I think in AD&D it tells me that they have a gaze that causes basically the same effect as a charm person. There it is. If a gaze is in a person's eyes, the vampire will have the effect of charming, with the victim subtracting 2 from the save of the person's magic. They behave as if they've been successfully struck with a charm person spell. Which is interesting. I don't know. That brings up the whole question of, like, what does it mean if they gaze into a person's eyes? Is that an action?
Right.
Is the vampire actively doing that? Or is it like a basilisk where I have to, like, shield my eyes and not look at the vampire, or I'm going to be charmed at any minute? Not totally clear, frankly, at least from the AD&D description.
And all those kinds of things, you know, if you get an opportunity to look at the original D&D description, right, you know, again, those things were written really sketchy. Bring
that one
up on screen.
We have that one. We have that one, yeah. Right? Can I put that one up on screen?
My number one.
This one?
Right. There you go. Totally.
Yep. Yeah. Yep.
So, about halfway down, it says, it's underlined there. It says, they charm men types merely by looking into their eyes, treat as a charm person spell with a -2 on their saving throw.
Yep.
So all the same questions are there about the, how do you, exactly how do you determine whether they've been immersed in running water? How do you determine whether you've hit them in the heart with a stake? We don't have any specific mechanics for any of that. And that's how the game was originally written. It was, you know, kind of like our 1 hour dungeon, Paul. It was intentionally left quite a lot for the DM to determine at the time. I will say that in my margin, I personally have decided that it does have to take an action and that the vampire does have to pick one person to target with it. And I feel like that represents the, I'm trying to, enchant one particular possibly romantic victim at a time and not like enslave a dozen people all at once. So personally, I do actually require them to target one person at a time.
Let me pop up the expert set, because of course my main entry point here is BX D&D, and I find this really fascinating because it's a little different here. What BX tells me is a vampire may also attempt to charm anyone who gazes into its eyes. Victim must save their spells to avoid the charm with -2 in the penalty on the roll. Charm victim will be totally under the vampire's control but cannot use spells or magic. No mention of the charm person spell here. An interesting qualifier of they can't use spells or magic, but they're totally under the vampire's control. Like, fascinating. I don't know why it gets this special treatment in BX.
Yeah, we've had the debate over charm many times before about how powerful is charm supposed to be. So I think that's partly reflective of when they originally wrote Charm Person, the first level spell in original D&D, it said completely under the influence of a caster. And then as time went on, they tried to dial that down. But then the problem is that they had it connected into these monster abilities like vampires and nixies and dryads and things like that. And they wanted to keep the total influence for the monsters, but they wanted to take out the total influence for the first level spell. And I think you're seeing this kind of split there. And they say the same thing in Gary's first edition Dungeon Master's Guide, is the place where he has to say, Charm Person the spell is not the same thing as Charm Person the monster ability. Charm Person for monsters like vampires is total control, but Charm Person for players, that's something different. So I think that's emblematic of them trying to split that ability there.
Fascinating.
Yeah. Do you like that, Paul? Do you like vampires having total control? Or does that seem overpowered or a violation of player integrity?
Well, for me, it's not. I like to play into this trope of them being this seductive creature. So, I prefer a sort of, you know, glassy eyed, mesmerized kind of effect. Where the you know, do they have total control? I like it a little more gray, I guess, than that. A little more gray. Okay. But again, I'm more using it in social situations rather than just like we're fighting the vampire and he's going to give up his attack this round to go charm one of his opponents to help.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, Disparal in the chat is reminding us, and of course he's right, that in the BX rules there by Mold Van Cook, even the charm person spell had this extra language inserted saying that a charmed caster can't use their spells or magic, just like you're seeing in the vampire entry here. So they're being consistent about that. And that was a point of debate. I've seen Frank Mentzer really kick back against that and say, this is a really core part of all my games, that charming enemy spellcasters and then using them as artillery was like a large part of the action in my dungeons all the time. So he was really not happy about that ruling, actually.
I guess I brought it up mainly just because I find it interesting that the expert version specifically doesn't refer back to the charm person spell, whereas AD&D does. That's
interesting.
Yeah. Have you had to adjudicate any of these gray area things in actual games, Dan? Have you had vampire fights where players have had to have tried to like submerge a vampire in running water or stab them in the heart with a
stake? Not in a long time. And so what I did years ago may not be exactly the same thing as I would do nowadays, as a matter of fact. Hmm. But have you recently?
In most of the encounters I've run, typically those things don't come out until the end, right? That like they usually battle the vampire into submission, right? Where the vampire is so beat up that it turns back into a gas and retreats to its home, to its coffin, and reforms there to regenerate. And then the players like bust in, and you know, at that point it's like, yeah, he's right there. I mean, pretty easy to just jam the, you know, stake into his heart. Or, you know, in the case of, I think in 10 Dead Rats, there was some talk of like, well, let's just chuck the whole box over the edge into the river. I'm like, that's pretty obviously submersed in running water. Like, there's not much debate to be had there. You know, so usually for me, it's not come up in like a round to round combat situation where I have to say like, well, does this count?
Personally, since it's in the text, I think I would be prone to allowing like a penalized attack roll to actually one-shot them. I will say this, you know, the one thing we haven't talked about is so when I did my, you know, monster assessment. So for OED on my site, oedgames.com, I have the monster database, which is, you know, my attempt at interpreting these kinds of gray areas actually in original D&D as best I can, and then running it through a massive simulator to estimate exactly how dangerous any particular monster is. And I don't call it challenge ratings, because generally nobody likes that, but I call them equivalent hit die ratings. And for the monsters in the Little Brown Book's original D&D, vampires came out as the most dangerous type of any monster. They came out to about 40 equivalent hit dice. So they're worth about 40 hit dice. And that is more in the Little Brown Books, at least. You know, this is before liches get invented. That's more than purple worms. That's more than hydras. It's more than large elementals. And on average, it's even worse than dragons. So the average vampire, according to my stats, is more dangerous than the average dragon in D&D. But the main reason for that is their summons ability. So they have that summons ability whereby they can summon at whim a score of wolves or 100 giant rats or something like that. And that, like all of a sudden, you think you're fighting a vampire, but you're not. You're fighting a whole army one round later. So granted their incredible peril like that, I think I would be prone to actually, you know, use the text that's there to also give them those weaknesses, which are very unusual, and possibly allow a character in the right place to actually one-shot them with like an attack roll at -4 or something like that. Is that crazy? Am I going to regret that?
I don't know. Let me, here's an interesting counterpoint, Dan. Because we haven't looked at this yet, but here's the 5e entry for vampire, which, as we can see, is quite long. There's a lot of stuff going on in here. But some of the stuff I found very interesting in here is a lot of the stuff just gets turned into damage. You know, the whole like sunlight or running water just as well causes this much damage.
Okay.
So they just lean into the, like, they have hit points, let's just cause some damage. But let me read you the stake to the heart entry. It tells me, if a piercing weapon made of wood is driven into the vampire's heart, while the vampire is incapacitated in its resting place, the vampire is paralyzed until the stake is removed.
Okay.
So not only is it qualified, you can't do it unless they're incapacitated and in their resting place.
Right.
And all it does is paralyze them. It's still not killing them. You still got to get them out into the sun or shove them into water or something.
Right. So that's a change from classic D&D, where it clearly said you stake them and they're killed. Where does that come from in pulp literature? Like, I feel like, where does that come in pop culture? Like, I feel I've had this like scene of open up the coffin and there's a vampire with a stake through the heart, and then some idiot removes it, and then you've got problems. Where am I thinking of that's had that kind of thing?
I don't know. Can't. Yeah, not sure. I couldn't tell you. It's fascinating.
Now, of course, as I mentioned, the summons, of course, John Miller is asking the obvious next question of what are the stats of 100 rats or bats in original D&D, because that's not given either. Yeah. And, of course, you're right. And, you know, neither are the wolves. They're not given the little brown books either. So, of course, there's this one entry in the monster listing that just says small animals, and the stats all say variable. So once again, the DM has to, on the fly, adjudicate or come up with stats for these animals that they're summoning. In my monster database, see, that's one of those things that I had to nail down. So in my monster database, I took the stats from rats in AD&D Monster Manual 2, and I used those, mm-hmm. matter of fact.
Okay.
And maybe that's a mistake. So that's a place where one could debate what one should do. I actually don't do a swarm type thing. My database actually does have you fighting 100 individual rats. So maybe that's where maybe that's why they're so dangerous in my system.
Just really interestingly, I'm trying to look at the expert rules, we get 10 to 100 rats or 5 mm-hmm. to 20 giant rats if you want. By 5th edition, we're down to 2d4 rats. Oh, but they're swarms.
What?
Swarms of bats or rats.
Okay.
So maybe they're 2d4 swarms, and maybe that's they're relying on just using the swarm mechanic. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Okay. When Gary and the 10 to 100 is right in the original book, it's the giant rat option that was added there. And when at least when Gary wrote stats for normal rats in Monster Manual 2, they are AC7, they're move 15, and they are hit points 1.
Interesting. Before we run out of time, because there's so much with vampires, that I feel like the major piece that we haven't covered here is, let me jump back to our AD&D entry here, is what happens when someone's slain by a vampire, right?
I wanted to point that out myself. I'm glad you're bringing that up, because I feel like that's a really essential paragraph here, which is the second to last paragraph.
Right. I mean, there's something I just love about the sort of pyramid scheme that is vampirism, and and it always, like, I feel like that always comes, it's come up anytime I've had vampires in my games, that inevitably they kill the vampire, and the question is, well, who is that vampire's master, and how high up do we have to climb the chain to get to the master?
Interesting.
Top of the pyramid. But here, AD&D tells us any human or humanoid drained of all life energy by a vampire becomes an appropriately strength vampire under the control of its slayer. Its transformation takes one day after the creature is buried, but if and only if the creature is buried. Is it going to be buried? Interesting. You ever had that happen in a game?
I have not. So that's really interesting. That is absolutely not a thing that I've paid a lot of. So in original D&D, it just says men types killed by vampires become vampires under the control of the one who made them. So that's a one liner right at the end that I have not dug into a whole lot. That's interesting.
There's another trope that I use in 10 Dead Rats that exists in Warhammer Fantasy, and it exists in sort of some modern shows like What We Do in the Shadows, which is that it's more than just draining them with the bite, but then also that the victim has to drink a little of the vampire's blood in return to actually become a true vampire.
Okay.
And often there's a middle ground of like, well, you got completely drained and you didn't get the kiss, as they call it. Maybe this is an Anne Rice-ism. I bet it is. Where now you're a thrall and you're like a different kind of undead. Not quite a real full on vampire in your own right, but
that shows up in later editions of D&D has a vampire spawn monster type, which is separate from vampires, which is exactly what you're talking about right there. And
we see that
in fifth.
In fifth, we get the target dies if it's talking about your hit point maximum going down. Is one of the things that happens when you get bit by a vampire. Target dies of this effect reduces its hit point maximum to 0. A humanoid slain in this way and then buried in the ground rises the following night as a vampire spawn under the vampire's control. So the idea there being, you know, so it's interesting. It still needs to be buried, but they're like tying the under the control to this idea of you're not a full fledged vampire, you're not autonomous. Gotcha. I guess you're, which is confusing. I guess I don't know. I'm surely there are games where players are like, but how do I become a vampire? I want to be a real vampire.
Yeah.
How do I do that?
I feel like, you know, this is similar to like a lot of pulp or pop cultural things around undead and how do you become them. It's interesting how that gets flattened out in D&D to you got to die. So a similar thing that I wrestle with, frankly, is the trope of what D&D calls ghouls, but a lot of movies call zombies or Walking Dead, right? How you get bitten. And then you get a fever and you transform into a ghoul or zombie without actually being like buried. And that's a thing that got ironed out of D&D is you got to die first, then you become the undead later on. And I do feel like that removes a little bit of the horror of the middle ground transformation happening. But anytime I try to think about possibly house ruling, you get bit by a ghoul and then you turn into a ghoul later. That seems really, really punishing for a player that might not know that's coming. So I haven't done that yet, but I'm always on the cusp of it, frankly. So the vampire bit is another interesting bit of like, I kind of wish that this like exchange blood and you're still alive and you transform. That's in some ways more compelling.
Yeah, but I like it. Yeah. And it's much more intentional, right? The question I think that comes up is like, well, vampires got to feed, right? So why isn't the world just populated with thousands and millions of vampires if every night vampires are out feeding on other people?
Or as Ash is doing the math right now, why wouldn't the entire world be converted in 34 days?
There you go.
Thank you for that exponential calculation.
I want to point out that in Night's Dark Masters, which is the Warhammer 2nd edition vampire book, there's, and I can't remember what period this comes out. It's got to be early 2000s, I'm guessing this book came out. We don't get to the concept of players as vampires until page 130. And there's a good four chapters at the beginning of this about why it's actually a bad idea. It talks about how it says the rules in the previous chapters may appear to discourage the idea of having players take on vampire characters. This is entirely deliberate. And then it goes on to give these reasons of like, first of all, Warhammer Fantasy is not a great game when your players are super high powered and have all these crazy abilities. Secondly, vampires are not a great protagonist. They're horrific, evil, selfish, amoral creatures. It doesn't make a compelling story. And then finally, they're like great villains. So why would you ruin that? Right? Why would you give up on having this drama of a vampire villain to play as vampires? It's just fascinating that, like, you know, and then of course they go on to like try to give you like, okay, well, here are some ideas how you might have players as vampires, but really strongly discourage it. Really,
it's interesting. Now, in that era, doesn't that have to be a direct response to Vampire the Masquerade? I mean, so that isn't that like around vampires' like height and popularity? And that sounds to me like a direct rebuttal.
So I'm looking it up. It came out in 2007, so it is slightly. It's a good 10 years later, right? This versus Vampire the Masquerade. So I don't think it's like an obvious dig against Vampire the Masquerade, but I would think that, you know, that it's a pretty valid point about like, just think of your AD&D game. Like, how much does it screw up your game when one of your players becomes a vampire or becomes a lycanthrope or et cetera? Right. Do you still have that player as a player at that point? I don't know.
The classic ruling would be they're out of the game. They're a bad NPC now. They're gone.
Yeah. Right.
And don't make anything, a new character. Any other option than that would be some kind of, I think, evolution from the original rule, I believe.
keep running it that way, I guess. Like, that's it, and that might be fun. You know, it's sort of similar to my story I told on the show. I can't remember if it was last week or a little earlier, of my player character who had his face ripped off by pixies, by evil pixies.
Right.
So you get the idea of like, well, players here, they've got a new character, but ha ha ha, I still get to use your old character as a villain now. Take that. I actually did that, and now that I'm thinking about it, I actually did that in a campaign. I had a campaign, my long-running BX campaign had some vampires in it. Surprise, surprise. Actually, the more I think about it, the more I realize, like, vampires actually feature in a lot of my games. That's interesting. Anyway.
Yeah, I see that.
There was a player who got attacked by a vampire at some point in his history, and then the player had to retire from the game. You know, life happens, he had to leave. And so I just took his character and I just transferred it. And I was just like, your character is now an NPC. You're like, you became a vampire. And then used his character in subsequent games, which was a lot of fun. And then I think, as I seem to recall, he came back at some point with a new character. And it was just a little bit of fun about how his old character was traipsing around the countryside as a vampire now.
Great.
Under my control as DM. Actually, so I guess I would encourage it. I think it's a great method. It's a great thing to do.
Oh yeah,
turn your player characters into villains. Why not?
And kind of like we were talking about last week. I mean, that shift in perspective is among the creepiest things you can do. Of like this character used to be an ally controlled by a friend who's a player, and then when that twists around to like, oh, all of a sudden they're being controlled by the nasty DMs. Among the creepiest switches that you can do in role playing, actually. So that's a wonderful bit. Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to point out, the funny thing is the paragraph that you were pointing to in the Monster Manual, in the first edition Monster Manual there, it's a really rich paragraph because, Paul, you were digging into the whole, vampire master bit. That wasn't even the thing about that paragraph that I wanted to talk about. So in that same second last paragraph, the interesting thing to me is that it's the first place in D&D where they suggest a monster having variable character levels. Because it says, if a player character gets killed, they're going to come back with the same class levels that they had. Therefore, you could have a vampire thief, you could have a vampire cleric, etc. You could have a vampire lord or a vampire wizard. And in the DM's guide that came out the next year, in the highest level of the dungeon encounter level, you've got vampires who are high priests, cleric level, I don't know, 10 to 14. You've got vampires that are high level wizards, level 9 to 15 or something like that. And to my understanding, that's the first time in D&D where the thought popped into anybody's head of attaching arbitrary class levels to monsters. Was specifically with the vampires, you know, because A, they're the top level master monster. B, they're pretty human-esque. You've got this situation of, like you were just talking about, of transforming your human PCs into vampires. And of course, by the time of like third edition, it just became, well, you can just add any class levels you want to anything, anytime you want. But that the separation between character, class, and monster was kind of a hard separation until that paragraph right there.
Fascinating. Fascinating. I had no idea that was that. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I was looking at that like a couple months ago is there any prior text in D&D saying that a monster can have arbitrary class levels, and I don't think anybody could find any before that paragraph.
All right.
Yep.
Then we're almost out of time, and we've done a whole episode on vampires and haven't even mentioned Ravenloft. I feel like...
Oh, my God.
how did that happen? I guess we're going to have to save Ravenloft for another...
Have you played Ravenloft, Paul?
I've run late Ravenloft, but it was a long time ago. Back in my high school days, I ran some Ravenloft. Though I will admit that we didn't play enough sessions of it that they never even got close to Strahd. That was just didn't even come up.
Gotcha.
So,
anytime anybody says that, I have not, but I've read it. And anytime someone says Ravenloft, the first thing that pops into my head is that amazing 3D isometric portrayal of the castle. And I wonder, is it playable? I haven't run it as a DM, so I don't know if that's confusing. We need to table that, Paul. Now we're doing the whole thing all over again. We're going to table it for Ravenloft.
There you go. We'll have a whole episode on Ravenloft, I guess.
I'm going to say one other thing before we leave about original D&D vampires, and I'm just looking at the original Matrix in the Little Brown Book, volume two there. And do I have my finger in the right place there? Where is it? Right here.
I cut you off right there with the credits.
Go on, Paul.
I was trying to bring up. Is this what we're looking at?
That's what we're looking at. So there's the slice of all the undead in the original D&D Little Brown Books, and they're all in one place on the table, and it ends with vampires there. And you notice that the first column is the number appearing. And so for vampires, you run into a random batch of vampires, and the note says that's mostly for the wilderness, and undead show up pretty predominantly in swamps and cities, actually. You notice that when you roll up a random vampire encounter, you get 1d6 of them. Roll a die. You don't get one vampire. Right, you probably get 3 or 4, if not 5 or 6. So here, friends, knowing that vampires are the most dangerous thing in the game, why don't you have a half a dozen of them? You're welcome.
That's pretty horrific. Jeez. All right.
That's how that worked. So you can see why I feel like when it said they are the most fear of the undead, I think I understand why. That's nasty.
That's what I mean.
Really nasty. And they show up in cities. That's a random city encounter right there.
Random city. Six vampires.
Six vampires.
Yeah, that's trouble. It's trouble. All right. That's that is definitely our time. Thank you, folks, for tuning in. If you have any thoughts on vampires in D&D, stuff that we missed, we didn't cover, questions about or comments about a potential for a future Ravenloft episode or other spinoff episodes about vampires, drop us a note in the comments. We'd love to hear from you.
We definitely do. If you're new to the show, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us, The Wandering DMs, on YouTube and Twitch and Twitter and Facebook and also GitHub. And we do have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites, so please look for us there.
If you prefer to listen to our shows in audio-only podcast format, you can find them on our website at wanderingdms.com. Likewise, you can find them on various carriers such as Google Podcast, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. If you're listening to us on one of those sites, please take a moment to rate and review us there. That helps other folks find our show, and we really appreciate it.
We really do. And of course, enormous thanks to our patrons who support our show. And if you'd like to join them, please do visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. You'll see several different tiers, including discounts on merch that we're adding to shortly, access to a private Discord server, monthly behind-the-scenes videos, polls, and surveys, and after-party chat that we'll be having every Sunday in about 10 minutes today, as a matter of fact. Don't forget that if you want more action with Count Orlok, please tune in to Paul's 10 Dead Rats campaign that'll be happening more Monday night, tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern time. We should tentatively have a new Book of War this coming Saturday. We've been off for a couple weeks for that. But don't forget that we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, so we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.